Welcome to Faithfully Memphis, a weekly podcast from the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. This is Sandy Webb, and I serve as the senior priest at Church of the Holy Communion in East Memphis. I'm excited to be your host this week. Our guest this morning is Mel Alborn, the principal of Illumination Studio in San Francisco, and a visual artist who has done extensive work at Church of the Holy Communion in Memphis over the last several years. Mel, welcome to Faithfully Memphis.
Thanks, Sandy. I'm so happy to be here.
We're so glad you are here. Mel, you've created an impressive body of sacred art using a diverse array of media. I personally have seen your work on canvas, on vellum, and even screen printed on vinyl. Two-dimensional, three-dimensional, even digital, you do it all. So here's my big question. What is the thread connecting all of these different media? What makes your art sacred?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question. That's a great question, Sandy. I love this question. What makes my art sacred? I think it kind of begs the question, what really makes any art sacred, or what makes anything sacred? And doesn't the answer really orbit around our faith? And also, even just our humble intentions to honor God. The question makes me think about baptism. I was recently at a beautiful baptism, the sacrament of baptism, and a celebration of that. What makes the water that we use for the sacrament of baptism, what makes that sacred? My simple lay answer to that is that we bless that water, and it's blessed also in community. And I think that's an important part. What makes the church building sacred? It's blessed, right? And it's blessed in community. I think there has to be a connection between our intention as a maker, our intention as a viewer, and also how something is used in community. Does that make sense? A little bit, as I'm saying that to you, I mean, what do you think makes art sacred?
It makes a lot of sense to me, Mel. As I think about baptism and other sacraments, what I look to is how God takes the ordinary and makes it into something extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And he does the same thing with our lives in so many ways, taking the ordinary and making it extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so think here, I'll give you two items, and perhaps you can tell me which item might possibly be more sacred, more holy than the other. So let's take one image. Let's take a hand-painted image of perhaps the Mother of God that has been painted hundreds of years ago and is sitting near an altar in a church and has been prayed at and had candles lit before it for many generations, for hundreds of years. So let's take that piece of art. And then let's take another piece of art. Let's take a postcard that is dog-eared and has been used as a bookmark in a family Bible for generations. The colors have faded. Perhaps the colors have even changed in an unpleasant way. And yet, for every family birthday, for every Thanksgiving prayer, that card comes out of the Bible and sits on the family table as grace is said. Is one more sacred than the other?
I don't think they are. I remember when I married, signing my wife into our family Bible and seeing where my mother's name had been written into that family Bible and where my birth had been recorded. The Bible, of course, is a sacred document, but that particular one made even more sacred.
Of course. And so it's us, isn't it? There's a piece of us in the making of the sacred. Even an ordinary object, any ordinary object, there's a piece of us in the way that we bless it, in the way we choose to use it to honor God. And for me, most especially too, when it's used in community somewhere. And I know, Sandy, you could tell me the proper passage, but when two or more are gathered, right? Didn't Jesus say that to us?
Then I'll be in the midst of them. Yeah. Mill, you had raised the image here of a Madonna and child, an image of the Mother of God holding our Savior in his arms. That's been an image that thousands of artists have rendered in thousands of ways over thousands of years. But I saw a particularly poignant version of it on your website just recently, where you describe the piece entitled The Addiction Madonna, an image of Mary and Jesus in which the figure's eyes are unfocused and the Christ child is depicted with some of the features that are common to children who are born with addiction. This had to be a difficult piece for you to create and perhaps a controversial one for you to share with the world. Tell us about this piece and the artistic process that led you to it.
Well, thank you for that, Sandy. Addiction Madonna is a very special painting for me. It has its beginnings in many places, in my compassion for those who suffer addiction, and suffer from addiction, for not all those who suffer from addiction are addicts themselves. It also has beginnings in my love for the old masters, in this case, Andrea Montagna, from about the mid-15th century. In my role as a student of fine painting, there's a form of teaching in fine art painting that involves copying the work of old masters. However, there's a twist to it. It's a copying, but not entirely. The student artist must make a change to the work. The younger artist must always have in some way an interpretation of what they've seen. And as I was beginning this particular painting, I was deeply moved by the individual struggles with addiction that plague so many people in our country and across the world, but especially in America. People close to me, people in my town, people I would see as I traveled, women who became addicts unknowingly after they had a necessary surgery to save their lives, to extend the time of their life, that wound up leaving them dependent on opioids, and through a series of circumstances, that dependence continued into full-fledged addiction. Underaged youth, simply looking for a way to rebel, you know, and somehow, instead of perhaps riding their bikes, you know, in the middle of the street, they wound up rebelling by falling prey to drug dealers who would offer them heroin at a price cheaper than beer. At the same time, I became aware of an old custom, especially in Europe and in Central America, where villages would parade through their streets with banners of the Mother of God, begging for her intercession, protect the village from plague, protect their sons and daughters going to war, heal the people, console the people. And so in this painting, this was my dedication to the Mother of God. This was my plea for assistance for those who suffer from addiction, whether it's an addiction to violence, to alcohol, to drugs. I think of it as my flag in the sand, you know, that I do not accept this as business as normal for America. Almost 1 million people have died in the last 20 years or so from overdose. Over 70% of those were opioids. And it's not just the addicts themselves that suffer the addiction. Think of all those who care for addicts whose lives have been destroyed by those whom they love who are addicts. The parents and grandparents who are raising their grandbabies and their babies of addicted family members, neighbors whose homes are unsafe because of the violence that is drawn to neighborhoods where addiction is rampant. So this is just my plea, Sandy, and I expect I'll be doing more work like this in the future.
There's a beautiful passage of scripture where Jesus looks at the crowd and the gospel writer tells us that he had compassion because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And of course, Jesus responded to them with his unique ability to heal and to teach and uplift. And I'm feeling the same heart breaking open with compassion in you and using the tools of your art and your gift to respond with compassion to the needs that you're seeing in the world. Mel, about 25 years ago, you created a network or participated in the creation of a network of Episcopal artists, and you've curated a number of exhibits of their work. Tell me about the process of creating that network, but also where you see commonality. Do other Episcopal artists approach their work with the same sense of compassion and heartbreaking open that you do?
Well, Sandy, you're speaking about Episcopal Church and Visual Arts. And yes, that's a nonprofit organization. It was founded in the year 2000 under the leadership of Presiding Bishop Frank Griswold and his wife, Mrs. Phoebe Griswold. And the artists of what we fondly call ECVA, E-C-V-A, I think each in their own way have felt and heard some kind of a call to use their creative gifts, to use their artistic expression in some way to share their faith. Artists and ECVA artists, they use all sorts of materials and media. We have photographers, we have painters, very traditional iconographers, modern interpretive iconographers. There are quilters and fabric artists, sculptors, printmakers, calligraphers, just all sorts, even found object artists, which sometimes are quite compelling. And I think what really is a common thread is this desire to explore their faith through an art medium. But with that, there's something more. With that is also their willingness. They're not only exploring their faith, which is a rather dangerous approach, I think, but they're also willing to share it, to expose it, to exhibit their creative process through this organization. And it takes a lot of courage, both really to look our faith in the eye and see what it's saying to us, and to do that by recording it so boldly with creative talent and artistic materials, and then to exhibit that. These artists are sort of small town heroes of mine.
I had never thought about the vulnerability of creating a piece of art and then releasing it to the world. When I'm talking to young couples preparing for marriage, I talk to them about levels of vulnerability, and often spiritual vulnerability is one of the areas of our lives that we guard most closely and that we're least willing to share, even with our most intimate partners. And for these Episcopal visual artists, it's taking an element of their faith and sending it out to the world to be seen and appreciated and loved, but also critiqued. There's a lot of vulnerability in that.
Oh, there absolutely is. And just, you know, pick any ECVA exhibition, and they're all online at ecva.org. Any exhibition, look at any of the work. But as you're looking at the work, take the time to both read the artist's statement and read their bio. We have exceptionally talented and brilliant people who are making this art. And through their artist's statements, many of them are sharing what that walk is like. They're sharing what has touched them. And so often where they are creating is precisely what you were talking about earlier, at that point of intersection between, you know, where their faith and their living of that faith in the outside world are meeting together. And there's some sort of friction. And this is how they're trying to sort it through. And they do it with art. And we're the better for it.
That idea of intersection is so interesting to me, because so many of the projects that you and I have worked on over the last more years than either of us would care to admit have been tailor-fit to a specific congregation. They answered a specific spiritual challenge for a specific group of people in a specific place. To what extent do you think art generally and sacred art specifically is local? And to what extent do you think it's universal?
I thought we had agreed you'd give me easy questions.
No comment.
Well, let's back it up even earlier than universal or local. Let's just go to fundamental and human, shall we? Because I think it is. I think some of the first things we do is babies. You know, we make little pictures, right? Art, I think, is a fundamental expression of being human. It's for many the evidence we leave of our living in this world. But we've learned some of this. How many thousands of years ago in cave paintings are there drawings? There are drawings of humans. There are drawings of buffalo, but there are drawings. And at the time that those drawings were made, that was local art. They were drawing one another. They were drawing the buffalo herds that sustained them, that they followed, as they were nomads throughout the plains that they lived in. It was the art, that art was local to them, but today it is universal to us. Today it represents a symbol for us, that mankind has wanted to say, I was here. And while I was here, this is what sustained me. This is what life meant for me. This is what was important for me. And so, yes, it's definitely universal. And it's at the same time local. Where each of us as individuals, each of us is going to have a reaction to a particular symbol in a particular way. I'll give you a kind of a simple example, a kind of a civic example. You know, let's say there's a veterans memorial in your town and you drive past it every day for 10 years. And you know that that represents for you the people that have served, the people that have helped keep this country safe. It's also a symbol of your hometown. Well, when you move away and you see a picture of that veterans memorial, what might that bring up for you? It might remind you of all of the generosity of the lives that have been given in order to keep us safe. Also might incur in you some memories of home, because that was home for so many, many years. And a symbol really can take on many, many different flavors. When we look at symbols related to our Christian faith, I think those are some of the most universal symbols we have in the world, don't you? I mean, you see a cross, right? You see a fish, wheat and grapes. Would you consider those universal?
They're certainly highly recognizable and draw us back to stories and faith and people.
Yeah, they do. And over how many centuries as well. And with that, regardless of what language you speak, what verbal language you speak, that visual language is really, that is universal, isn't it?
Mel, one of the things I've learned from you in some really profound ways is the importance and nature of symbol and the way that they appear in art. You just carried us all the way back to the original cave paintings, which of course had images of people saying we're here, but also symbols about their culture and about their life. Some of the most ancient representations of Egyptian art and other non-Western traditions are highly symbolic. To what extent is symbol a language, and to what extent are we losing that language today?
Oh, goodness. Well, that's probably my favorite subject, don't you think, Sandy? I love talking about this.
I've heard you bring it up before, yes.
Yes. Well, because our our churches are filled with a visual narrative of our faith that is universal. That visual narrative is universal. You could see a painting of an angel in East Memphis, Tennessee, and a painting of an angel across the globe, and it's the same angel. It has the same meaning. But there are more symbols of our Christian faith that are a little bit more specific, and I believe a little less well known. Most of us would recognize, if I said to you, wheat and grapes, I think most people, well, unless they're on your grocery list, right? It's an ordinary object, right? It's an ordinary object, but yet our intention and our use of that, our intention on how we honor God with that object, our intention on how that becomes sacred, those become symbols of the Eucharist, of the Last Supper. Yes. The fish. How many different ways have we and different stories have we heard from the New Testament that involve fish and the fishermen, the disciples, the miracles, all of that. But I don't know. I think fewer and fewer people, when they see those symbols, are drawing those connections. You know, the symbol of Cairo, the monogram of Jesus, the IHS, Agnus Dei, the Lamb of God. The peacock, the symbol of the resurrection, the phoenix, the pelican plucking its breast, the lion, the do these symbols, if you were to ask your congregation today, could they explain what they referred to in a Christian context? You know, what would they know? And does it matter? I think it's only fair to ask, would they know, and does it really matter? To someone like me, who loves the heritage and the continuum of the Christian visual vocabulary, I say it does matter. And I think we're in danger of losing that language unless we find more people younger than me that begin practicing it more and more. That it becomes a part of our Sunday school curriculums, you know, and that it becomes more of our preaching, using our churches as part of that proclamation, right? The silent charism of visual preaching, so that we can continue to extend the use of this glorious language, this visual narrative for the future.
You raised the symbols of wheat and bread, which is another classic example of God taking the ordinary and making it extraordinary.
Absolutely.
And two, taking an image that of itself might be quite plain, but when attached to the symbol that carries it back and connects us to 1,000 years of Christian heritage and practice, becomes something quite extraordinary.
Oh, it does. And to think, I mean, I was talking about this just the other day. I was looking at some wall paintings from the late first century, and it occurred to me, my goodness, the person doing these paintings in around 185 AD, okay? You know, assuming a lifespan of about 60 or so years, their great grandmother could have been washing her sheets at the lake when Jesus and all those fishermen came by, and she goes home and says, "You'll never guess what happened to me today. Here I was, beating my sheets with the rocks on the side of the lake, and there this big crowd showed up, and this man started teaching. And then. And so these catacomb paintings are really a family storybook that's told over and over and over again. And we still tell these stories. They're in our stained glass windows. They're in the graphics that we send out in our Sunday newsletters. But they're just an age-old family story. And I don't know, I just love that. It makes me want to say, okay, so if that's the case, And you know that we say, as it was in the beginning, right, is now and ever shall be. Well, okay. So Sandy, remember that day when Creator God separated day from night? You know, do you remember? You know, perhaps we should, you know, perhaps we need to ask ourselves that question. Anyhow, I think I digressed.
And maybe we need some symbols to remind ourselves of it and draw our hearts back. Mel, as an artist yourself, when you're approaching a new work, how do you approach, at what point in the work do you start to think about and introduce symbol? Does that come right at the beginning? Does that come after you've gotten a sense of where the work is going? How does that, how does symbol work its way into your creative process?
Symbol is always an essential element in any commission and any creative process. Symbol follows function and form. So the first and early questions are, what is this that we are creating as co-creators and collaborators? What is it that you need this to do? We talk a little bit about the particulars. Where would you like this to go? And what are the elements that you know must be included? And once we have that framework laid out, I always introduce, as you well know, the question of what is it, how will this proclaim itself to your community, and what symbols of our faith need to be a part of this.
In so much of your work, I've seen that represented here at Church of the Holy Communion, when you were creating an image to go behind our high altar. We incorporated images of the Eucharist because this is Church of the Holy Communion. In work that we've done in other areas of our lives, I've seen you incorporate symbols of family and working those in such that the art is particular, not just a beautiful work given from one person to the next, but something that's completely unique to that family and that expression.
Well, and isn't that accepting the gift of the opportunity and bringing it to life? That's how I see that. And it's a way of honoring time spent for those who are creating or co-creating the work. It is a way that they also participate and leave their own mark by assisting generously with the listening sessions and the discussions and the selection process. And for Church of the Holy Communion and for your docile cross, we were able to incorporate, really to quote several existing symbols on your high altar and bring them into the cross, so that the cross was not sitting independent of your heritage altar, your heritage, what do we call the part up at the top with the beautiful?
The cornice.
The cornice, thank you. You know, those pieces that have been a part of Holy Communion, I believe, since its founding. So this cross, while it takes its place as a newer element in your sanctuary, your nave, your worship space, it also actively reaches back and holds hands with what was created at its founding so many years ago. And that continuation of the heritage, that dialogue, even if it's silent, to me is very, very important.
One of the strangest things, though certainly not the strangest thing that I've been asked to do since coming to Church of the Holy Communion, was when we were starting that project. You asked me to go around the church and take a picture for you of every engraving, every image, every symbol, so that you could figure out what the symbol system was that your piece would be entering into.
Yes, I did. I remember. And we did. We did, didn't we?
We certainly did.
We did. And how was that received when you unveiled the cross? Because you, as rector, undertook a delicate and yet necessary step, because your docile curtain could no longer serve. It had served for 70 or so years, yes, and could no longer serve. So how did you approach the conversation with your congregation and with your leadership and with your founding families, the need to retire that heritage docile curtain and to bring a new symbol to your altar?
The project that you're referring to, Mill, of course, is Church of the Holy Communion's need to replace the large piece of art that stood behind our docile curtain since we opened on this site in the early 1950s. It was an emotional process to let go of an old friend who had been with us through all of the events that take place in the church. What I was most impressed with, though, is that when the new one was unveiled and installed, it was immediately accepted because we had done that work to say, what are the symbols that are already in this space? What are the symbols that will make this piece feel as though it had always been there?
Yes, I remember that. And I remember the generosity of your renovations committee and each of its members and their willingness to do the hard work. And it was very hard work that they did to sit through the renderings, the sketches, they worked so hard, Sandy, to visualize what I was trying to show them could be possible. And in the end, the result to me was very, very humbling, because I think what you created is just right for your congregation and for your space. And it was a privilege to participate and help that work along in some small way.
I think our lay leaders did a good job of articulating, and you did a great job of helping them visualize, putting those images onto the words that they were saying.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And in the end, well, and we won't go through this, I think, here, but we did bring representative symbols of the three persons of the Trinity quietly into that piece. And it simply brings together just the theology of the Episcopal faith in one quiet symbol.
Quiet and beautiful symbol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mill, as we begin to wrap up our conversation, I'd like to ask you about the letter to artists that was issued by Pope John Paul II shortly before his death. I know that this document is profoundly important to you. Tell us about the former Pope's letter to artists and what its significance is.
Oh, this is a remarkable letter, and I would encourage everyone to read it, because not everyone is aware of the great theologian that John Paul II was. This was a letter he wrote to artists and published on Easter. I think it was 1999. And when he opens his letter, he's addressing this to artists, and he calls them, he says, "Oh, you artists, you ingenious creators of beauty." What a way to get someone's attention. And I have used that phrase in workshops with artists, and I have them writing back to me, signing themselves, you know, Jane Doe, comma, ICB, ingenious creator of beauty. I just love that. But John Paul II's view of the artist who works at the intersections of art and faith, he poses that artist hears some echo of the mystery of creation with which God has wished in some way to associate with the artist. So he's saying there's some echo of the mystery of creation that God wishes the artist to hear. That's so profound. And I think it's true. When I think of the artists of Episcopal Church and visual arts, it's so. They do hear that echo. It is a form of a call for them. And John Paul II goes on to say, artists are constantly in search of the hidden meaning of things, and their torment is to succeed in expressing the world of the ineffable. Also true. Absolutely true. And he thinks that there's mutual spiritual enrichment between the church and the artist, and that it is good for the church to appeal to artists, to appeal to creators, especially contemporary creators, that the church needs the artist very, very much in order to express in that silent visual language, right? That charism of visual preaching that art can be. And I just think that the letter itself, it has so many layers. It has about 14 parts. And I would encourage anyone who is interested in the subject of art and faith, whether they are on the commissioning side because they work in leadership in the church, or they're artists interested in continuing their work in sacred art and art and faith. The letter is it's worthy of some time.
Mill, we've invoked the names of two international church leaders in the course of this conversation. Pope John Paul II, of course, the international head of the Roman Catholic Church at the beginning of this century, and also presiding Bishop Frank Griswold, the international head of the Episcopal Church from, I believe, 1997 until 2006. Each of them, from their position of leadership, reaching out to artists to encourage them and to lift them up and to lift up their place in the church. Imagine for a second, as my last question, that you needed to write a letter to artists, or perhaps a letter to the church about the arts. What would it include?
Well, if I was writing a letter to artists, I would probably be brief. If I was writing a letter to the church, I might be a little more long-winded. I'll have to think about the second one. But for the first, I can answer the first rather readily. My letter to sacred artists today would say something like this. Sleep less. Create more. Polish your craft. Increase your own personal standards of excellence. Brave it up. People may not like what you do, and they may not understand what you do. Do it anyway. Exhibit widely. Pray deeply. Ask the Holy Spirit to guide you with grace. And when you receive the call to serve, say yes and mean it.
Mill Elborn, principal of Illumination Studio, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for reminding us that creation isn't just something that happened in the past, but something that continues in our midst every day. Thank you for being our guest on Faithfully Memphis. Thank you for listening to Faithfully Memphis, a podcast from the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. We invite you to share our show from today with a friend who may not have heard it. And if you like our show, please leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts. This really helps our work. You can learn more about the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, including finding an Episcopal church in our diocese on our website, edwtn.org. We're also active on Facebook and Instagram. This has been Sandy Webb, Rector of Church of the Holy Communion for Faithfully Memphis. Until next time, stay safe and stay positive.